time for hour one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Happy Future Tuesday, and the future starts now.
You heard it here.
Where was it, anyway?
The future?
Yeah, I think it disappeared somewhere.
Ah,
it's
yes.
Back. It's back.
One of those little dimensional shifts that you like to do during the show.
I do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we did see something that portends to the future here in Santa Cruz this weekend. That was a lot of fun. The Santa Cruz Mini Maker Faire over in the West End.
That's right. People making up the future as we go along.
Though, Mrs. Future, I noticed that you seem to be particularly interested in an exhibit that was taking us into the deep past.
Yes. Some futurists from a few hundred years ago, from the 1800s.
Well, 100 years ago, 150 maybe, yes.
Ada Lovelace and Lord Babbage.
In person
at this year's Santa Cruz Mini Maker Fair.
I know. These people dressed in costume, and they looked like they were literally from the 19th century, and they were in charge of this exhibit of the Babbage difference engine.
That's right. Which, of course, was the precursor of computers. It was the first blueprint for computers. It was never made by the original mathematicians, Babbage or Lovelace, but they created
what a mechanical computer would be like in the 19th century.
And it was kind of akin to a combination lock where you have the numbers, except that all of the dials for the numbers were interconnected. It was a counting machine, basically. And what I learned that I never knew before is that the reason why Babbage was creating a machine was because in order to do navigation in that era, they created all of these tables of measurements to calculate, I guess, position and time of day.
Polynomial calculations of all kinds.
Yes.
Now, they had to carry these little books around with tables in them.
Yes, and these tables were really just the answers to the equations that would be necessary to do your navigational calculations. But the tables, a lot of times, they had huge mistakes in them. And so you would look up a number to calculate your location while you're sailing the sea, and the number would be mistyped. There'd be a typo. And no one would know until it was too late.
So Babbage felt
that the...
It was a waste of time.
The way to solve this problem was
to have
a machine calculate the tables, and then as that number got calculated, that number would be typeset into a page, and so there would be no mistake. So that was the first computer, was this typesetting machine driven by this number cruncher. And all of the math was addition. And so even though it was looking for exponents of numbers, you know, like n to the nth or something, it was doing it all by math, by just adding the next set of numbers and then writing that down.
Great idea. It didn't happen until many years later, I think, in the late 19th century. Steampunk. It was kind of steampunk computers at the time.
Well, I don't think a Babbage engine was created until, like, 1995 or something.
It stayed
on paper until...
This one was made out of Meccano parts. Meccano is kind of like an Erector set kind of toy stuff.
Uh-huh.
Literally, the guy put 10,000 hours or so building this.
Uh-huh.
It's an insane design. Anyway, that was one of the things in the Santa Cruz Maker Faire, Mini Maker Faire this weekend.
Yeah.
The little rocket, paper rocket launches, I thought were really cool.
Right.
The kids were all into launching paper rockets. Really fun.
They also had some really great tools there. There were some titanium tools for sawing that were really
some
great.
Some innovative tool designers here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
The New Concepts.
Yes, New Concepts.
K-N-E-W. Sounds like a radio station.
Right. Very lightweight, very strong tools for doing like precision skill saw stuff or your own personal saw. You know, you can saw metal with it.
Yeah, so there were the robots too, the insectoid cockroach robots that kids seem to really enjoy playing with.
Yeah, and apparently these are kits that kids can buy, that parents can buy, whatever. And the kids can put together these robots that know how to redirect themselves if they run into a wall, sort of like a Zumba vacuum cleaner.
If then statements, right?
Right.
If I hit a wall, then turn left.
Right. And I think that they also know how to see light, and so they can be directed with light. And
like cockroaches.
Yeah, they have several behaviors that they can do.
Yes, I guess the simple insects would be an example of the first simple robotic computers we'll have at home for the kids to learn.
Yeah.
Of course, the grasshopper ones I'm a little worried about. They get out of bounds real easy.
Right.
So what do you got here, Mr. Beecher? Robotic exoskeleton for the stabilization of tremors.
Right.
Ooh. Yeah, so like if you have Parkinson's or something like that, you can
So there's a lot of
compensate.
Stuff for kids interested in robots. And something else that we really loved a lot was the...
Oh, yes. The little personal looms that they had there. Yeah. Weren't they cool?
Yeah.
And they had boys using them too, because they were kind of like computery, but they weren't. They were made out of pretty much wood, right? Really fine wood designs, but they allowed people to design. I think the kid that I saw was designing some kind of really cool knitted case for his iPad.
Right. Yeah, but you know, you had kids sitting in basically like a glorified sewing machine where they had to push the thread back and forth, and with their feet they would change the orientation of the threads that were being woven.
Move some up and down so that you can slide this thing between the threads as it separates them.
So, really interesting. Old-fashioned.
Yeah, so Santa Cruz, as usual, was not so much totally techie for the fair, but had a lot of arts and crafts elements to it, too. A lot of stuff to do with hands, except for the R2-D2 gang.
That's right. The R2-D2 gang was there looking very futury.
This is a local special interest group, shall we say, of people who build R2 units. Remember the R2 units from Star Wars? There's R2-D2 and C-3PO. This is the R2 people.
Right.
And it makes all the cool little R2 sounds. We also had some of the art cars that actually go to Burning Man and the big Maker Faire next month. One of them looks like it's a dragon, right? It's a huge, but it's got a half a dozen dragon heads on the front end that actually emit flame, and a big bubble cockpit, like kind of like a helicopter, at the right up below the dragons as you drive.
At this Maker Faire, since it was so kid-centric, you could get into this mechanical dragon and you could move the dragon heads around, but they didn't have flaming today. Yeah, they weren't blowing fire.
Still, it's one awesome vehicle.
Right. All right, folks, we're going to be back with a lot more stuff for you right after this break. This is the Dr. Future Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Also in the news, the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module was successfully installed at the International Space Station over the weekend.
Hey, a new era has begun.
Don't you think? Yeah, that's an inflatable space habitat. That's the beginning of hotels in space.
That's right. So apparently the first room in the hotels in space is just been attached to the International Space
Station.
Size
of a small bedroom.
That's right. It's about 595
inflatable
cubic feet. That's 8x8x8-ish in that range.
What's special about this one is that it is human-friendly. The astronauts will be able to actually go into it if they want to get away from the metal of the space station and just hang out in cloth.
Sure, it's like going and hanging out inside of a
Kevlar
canvas bubble.
Much more friendly Kevlar experience.
Everybody always loves a round room, right?
Roundness.
I'm sure they
feels
need
so
a
good
few of those
space,
up at the space stations every now and then.
I haven't noticed the windows on it, though. It looks
I don't think it has windows.
No, how can you have windows on a cloth spaceship?
Maybe they'll have screens, you know?
Screens.
You can get some video.
Keep the bugs in.
I guess they just want to, they have a few things to figure out before they worry about seals on the inflatable windows.
I think so. They're just developing the whole idea, inflatables. Now, inflatables were something that NASA had thought about a while ago, like in the 60s and 70s. They decided not to go forward with that. But Bigelow Aerospace took up some of that research and took it forward. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, they were doing the first inflatable experiments in space, and now they're actually creating them so they're habitable environments.
Yeah. I noticed this article didn't really say how the inflatable gets inflated. You have to bring some air up there or something to inflate it, right?
Astronauts have lungs.
Yeah, they're going to blow it up like a big balloon.
Yeah, that's it. They should have that as an emergency mode at least. No, yeah. I'm sure they have tanks.
No, yeah, I'm sure that they brought up enough compressed air to put in there too. I'm sure that's part of the supply when they put a new room.
You bring
room
up
in
a
space.
New room, you bring up your gas too.
That's right. You bring up the whole thing. It's sort of like that joke about millennials, right? Yeah. If you ask millennials if a glass is half empty or half full,
who owns the glass? You're saying?
It's close. No, you know, in the past, you figure the optimist would say the glass is half full. The pessimist would say the glass is half empty. Well, millennials, being so Google scientifically aware, they say, well, the glass is totally full. It's got liquid and air. You know?
Yeah, there's always something in it. Get real.
That's right. So, same thing with the Bigelow Hotel. It's called the Beam.
The Beam Room. Yeah. And that's where you can go up there and you can watch all the great celestial activities that will be happening.
But like, not from inside the room.
Well, unless they, I guess they're going to have some kind of 8K monitors. By the time they have people up there, it'll be 8K. It'll look like photorealistic, like the real thing, only better. Uh-huh. And you'll be able to see stuff outside of just the local environment. Yeah, it's great to see the Earth and stuff. But wouldn't you want to be able to, say, watch these colliding black holes that are happening in another part of the universe? That was a big story this week, too.
Definitely. How can we do that? Can we watch a colliding black hole?
What
do you have for us here, Dr. Future? I know you've got something about black holes.
Yeah. Well, there was a story that caught my attention. Let me see if I can pull this up here. Yeah. It was colliding black holes. And what was really surprising our scientists was that these two giant black holes colliding, as they combined, they were expecting it to be just dark because black hole...
Yeah, you'd figured black hole plus black hole equals
black hole.
Bigger black hole.
No, but some kind of gamma ray light came out of it.
Hmm.
Like a gamma ray burster of some sort. And they're trying to figure it out. So what? WTF, you know? Where did that come from? So it's a light flash from a black hole collision. This will rewrite the books on black holes.
Hmm. Well, I can't wait to see that article. I don't see it in the links, though.
I just found it. When black holes collide, do they hide in the dark or emit flashes of light? That is the question on many scientists' lips right now. It's something to do with the gravity waves being generated by the collision and light. It ripples the fabric of space-time itself.
Hmm, right. Yeah.
Now, the black holes are pretty big. They're 30 times the size of the sun.
Right, where are they located?
Didn't say here exactly where. Hopefully far from us. Because you know those gamma ray bursters? If it is a true gamma ray burst, some of these can be like more dangerous than like an emission from the Death Star. Seriously.
Yeah, if you're anywhere near
gamma
them.
Ray boost, they're a very powerful radiation burst that can literally destroy planets.
Sure.
That are in front of it. You don't want to get in the way of a gamma ray burst beam. Yeah. No, no, no.
Well, a black hole, these black holes are probably bigger than our sun, right?
30 times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And black holes themselves, they don't radiate light at all. Typically, they absorb it.
That's the name.
Yeah. And in the center of all the galaxies, there's a monster black hole. Like, they could absorb the entire galaxy if they wanted to. However, these merging ones, they circled each other for millions of years first. They thought, well, maybe the light coming from this convergence of two black holes came from maybe some of the solar systems and the stars that they were swallowing as they vortexed in around the black hole. But no, the scientists say that they've had 100 million years or so as they approach each other for all the stars in the area to be already have been absorbed. So they wouldn't create the light. So where's the light coming from?
Has to happen fast.
That's a very big mystery, and Stephen Hawking would be a good guy to talk to about that since he's been a black hole aficionado since the early days of thinking about them. How could black holes generate light? You know? Big mystery of the day, or the year at least, I would say.
Yeah, well, we're not in that range of science, but it just seems like if there's so much energy, the amount of light, I guess the light when you combine two black holes is the part that can escape. Where it couldn't before when it was just one black hole, but now there's like extra energy. So all that light that has been energized moves away from that, they call it the event horizon, is the edge of the black hole. That's where light has to decide whether it's going into the black hole or escaping, right? So some of that light escapes.
Well, I think the most interesting theory I've heard is that the black holes are actually inside the womb of a new star that's forming, a giant star. And so these black holes combine, they're actually combining inside the womb of a new star system forming. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's another theory.
All right.
But I think we've explored this to the nth degree here, so let's move on, shall we?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's it. The black holes are over.
Well, I think they'll always be here. But for the show here, I've got too many interesting stories. Stephen Hawking's. Uh-huh. My goodness. He was in another piece this week. Remember Linda Moulton Howe was talking about this. It was about the spaceships the size of a little wafer that are sent to other star systems on the top of a laser beam.
Right, yeah, they're calling them spaceships, even though they're the size of a postage stamp.
Wafer ships.
You can't really see them when they're even close. As soon as they're 100 feet away, you don't even know they're there.
Yeah, and there's an interesting team of people, including Stephen Hawking, that support this idea. Mm-hmm. And a Russian billionaire, I believe, who's willing to drop $100 million on this project of actually building one. It looks like you could send spaceships to the nearby star system in about 20 years. And once you're there, you can send back a transmission at the speed of light. Mm. So that would take about 4 years. So you could have a complete round trip of information in the lifetime of a human.
40 years.
I mean, it could easily be, not easily. That's the thing. Now they're saying, okay, well, what do you have to do? You have a really powerful laser beam to constantly push this little wafer close to the speed of light.
Oh, you can't just do it your laser pointer, I guess.
No, you can't.
How big does this laser have to be?
No, it's a crowdsourced laser pointers, right? We get a million people with their laser pointers every night. Uh-huh. No, it's not going to work that way. They have to build an actual giant array of laser beams converging on this little dot, a little wafer, mm-hmm. that's being sent to Alpha Centauri.
I see.
A distance of 4.2 light years from Earth, the closest star system to the
Sol. How big is this laser array to push this little?
It's
got to
be acres and acres, acres and acres of laser.
Not to a galaxy, it's to the next star.
To the next star. I mean, we're not even talking
galaxies. We're just talking stars.
Huge distances.
We're talking our closest neighbor.
Yeah, we're talking a few trillion miles. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, nothing.
All right.
And the cosmic scheme of things. But still, it's something because it expands the range of human exploration, a quantum leap forward in that, without having to violate any of the laws of physics.
We don't have to invent warp drive or anything. Shows that we can move something fast, right?
We can start accelerating matter to very super high speeds without having to be in a linear accelerator or something like that. Isn't that cool? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so
there are obstacles, right?
Yeah, other stuff in space. That's the biggest problem. They
zap something.
Yeah.
Earth as Death Star.
That's the biggest concern right now. What might we hit?
All right, we got to go to a break right now. We'll be back after some CBS News here on the Dr. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Now, from the outer reaches of outer space to our own backyard, I thought we'd look at this another mystery, a scientific mystery that is being figured out right now, and that has to do with the monarch butterflies.
Oh, that's always a local wonder.
Monarchs, yeah.
The monarchs.
The ones that migrate thousands of miles every year.
That's right.
Spend the winter in southern Mexico.
Yeah.
With no GPS.
Yes.
How do they do it?
Baja to Santa Cruz.
And how do they do it? How do they do it? Well, previous research found that they use the position of the sun in the sky combined with an internal clock to determine which way is south. It's called a time-compensated sun compass.
Okay.
But the scientists have been puzzling over how this information is integrated and turned into action in the little butterfly brain. How does it know which way to flutter its wings? So there's a team that's trying to figure out neurologically, and they just had a model that's described in the journal Cell Reports this week. And they have all the pieces together, and they're just looking at how these connections occur. When a monarch is flying on a sunny day, its eyes are constantly registering where the sun is in relation to the horizon. And although the sun usually travels east to west, the butterfly needs to be able to determine which is which at a given moment, right? So that's where the circadian clock comes in. Because inside the insect's antennae are these little circadian clocks, biological clocks. And they help the butterfly determine what time it is. So if the sun is close to the horizon, these clocks indicate where it is rising or setting, and therefore to flutter east or west. if they can tell the difference between the morning and the afternoon, then they can change how to fly, their directions, where to keep the sun in relation to their flight.
Hmm. All right, let me see if I can make sense out of it all here in my own little butterfly brain.
Okay.
So basically in the morning, I make sure that if I want to go north, the sun is rising in the east, and so I make sure that it's off to my right. And if I want to go south, then in the morning, the sun is still rising in the east, and I want to make sure that it's on my left so I can fly south.
Yeah, you got the basic.
Basically how their little brain works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they, at night, they switch that. Or in the afternoon.
They switch it. Yeah.
Well, okay.
Combining the compass
brains,
day. All right. Well, that's all. We don't have to
intact.
Get too crazy about this. But,
hey, we have Rigel Scott from Scotts Valley would like to say something about black holes.
Yes. Okay. Let's go back into outer space for a moment with our friend from Scotts Valley.
That's right. Time traveling backwards towards the black hole. Hi, Rigel.
Hey, you might know my parents, Alan Nebra.
Alan Debra.
Oh, it sounds like a star system to me.
Rigel. Yeah, they're in the lower part of Orion's belt. So here's the deal. So when the universe is expanding, it's going to contract here really soon, but when it contracts, for every piece of matter, every action, opposite and equal reaction, there is a black hole everywhere. It's everywhere. It's within every star, within every planet. That in the circular world, that's what happens. And here's the deal, guys. You talk about, to get to the next star system, you have to bend time and space, correct?
The tesseract. Well, classically, yeah. But the model that we put out there, it just uses laser beams as with using classical physics. So we didn't have to do anything. But yeah, okay, bending time and space. Okay, that's the classic way, that science fiction-wise anyway. Go ahead.
So I want to give you something here. So you talk about perspective. You could take the size of a quarter. That little three light triangle you could be watching it. It could land in your backyard.
Yeah.
So that little 1 foot, 3 foot triangle, you could walk inside of that thing and you would have 2 miles. That's space and time right there. And that's what those big triangles, flying triangles that you see.
Yeah.
They're nuts and bolts, but inside of those things is a whole parallel universe and dimension. I mean, you can put the whole catcher's mitt in there. Hillary Clinton and all her kin and all the evil people, they can all go away in the size of a quarter.
Really? You can open up a dimensional portal and send all our problems there?
All right.
There?
Thank you, Rigel. I'm so glad that we have a local star calling to set us all straight so we can understand time and space a little better.
We put it in a request for a dimensional portal to clean up this planet.
Live long and prosper, my friend.
Yes.
Thanks, you too. All right. We got all kinds of folks listening.
A dimensional portal, huh?
That's right. Dimensional portals and local stars. I guess not so local.
Yeah. Well,
sort of local. Local enough to call.
It's kind of what makes what's not local, local. Kind of like our communications does to distance here on this planet. Where it's not so far to talk to somebody on the other side of the planet anymore. It's no big deal.
Sure, yeah.
Right, so maybe that same principle applies on a universal scale where what seems far, like these star systems, are really totally accessible from another dimensional point of view.
That
space-time itself. A lot of people call it an illusion, but I prefer to think of it as just maybe just a few of the dimensions, that there may be more dimensions to reality that... that allows us to what we call bend it.
It boggles the mind.
Yeah, yeah. Anything is possible, really. It's really what it's coming down to.
Yeah. Well, the reality is far more complex than we can know.
Well, still, what we figure out, we're very clever monkeys. What we figure out, we can do some serious fun with. We can actually do interdimensional portals. I think a lot of conspiracy theories delve into that arena where they see the dimensional portals as already having been accomplished a long time ago, and there are certain guardians of these portals that are secret within our society.
Well, speaking of guardians of portals, we have another caller. Anthony wants to talk to us a little bit about butterflies.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
Yes, our local...
Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Anthony.
Probably everybody who lives in Santa Cruz has at one time or another been up to natural bridges to see monarch butterflies.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's incredible.
One of our treasures.
What I've always wondered is, how come those butterflies are landing in eucalyptus trees? Eucalyptus trees ain't native to North America. The reason we have so many eucalyptus groves in North America is because back in the 1800s, the railroad moguls were looking for a fast-growing hardwood to make ties out of, and it turned out that there was too many knots in the eucalyptus wood, so they never used them anyway. But so why do those butterflies land in eucalyptus trees?
Well, oh. What do you think?
I don't have any idea. It doesn't make any sense to me. All of a sudden, there's eucalyptus trees, and they decided they like them better than the palm trees? I don't know.
Yeah,
but I'll take your answer off the air if you know.
Well, we're just guessing, I'm sure. But Dr. Future is definitely getting it to his fingertips.
I am a quick Googler.
That's right.
Okay.
He has fast access.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. And what did you find out for us there?
Yes. Oh, I am absorbing data as we speak. No single monarch makes the entire journey. It takes two or three generations of monarchs to make the entire round trip. That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Wow.
Yeah. Eucalyptus are the preferred trees for overwintering monarchs. Three types of trees were used by roosting monarchs: eucalyptus, pine, and cypress.
Hmm. So they like the smell, probably. All of those have really
eucalyptus,
nice
75%, pine 20%, cypress 16%.
Hmm. And they're all very tall.
And 12 other tree species are also used if they can't use those.
Hmm. So maybe they like the height, the warmth, and the smell.
Yeah. That's, maybe it's like
off the top of my head.
Okay, how about this? They were here before. Perhaps in the past they preferred more native plants, perhaps the pine. And then along comes our species, and we bring in the eucalyptus trees. And it might be to monarch butterflies like chocolate or sugar is to us.
Oh, they're like, ooh, how exotic, new trees.
Yeah.
Let's try these.
So those fun little walking bipeds came by and planted these. Yummy. So maybe something like that happened. It was just a preference that happened through serendipity.
Could be. All right, we've got another caller here.
Okay.
Let's say hi to Steve from Morgan Hill. Hi, Steve.
Hey,
welcome,
Steve,
to the show. You got about a minute before we take a break.
Yeah, we got about a minute before our break. What's up in
your world?
Yeah.
I'd just like to ask you a question. What is the commonality between how did Michelangelo paint the Sistine Chapel and do the Statue of David, and how do all of the amazing things Newton and Einstein and all these breakthroughs take place? They somehow access the superconscious, which is the mind that's running the entire universe, every good thing, none of the bad stuff. Well, that's another discussion where that comes from, but we already know. But anyway.
Yeah, superconscious. Well, that is like what a lot of spiritual religions would call the Godhead, perhaps, or connection with the divine.
In or one way creativity, or the creative force.
It's a reality. Go ahead. You have a certain insight into this, I can see.
Yeah, it's a superconscious. And birds and Chelsea Islanders and Michelangelo and people that do amazing things.
Yes.
George Berkeley University is named after him. He talked about the immaterial world. Mm. We should be paying more attention to the immaterial world. Faith, hope, love, courage, friendship, all the great things. Love are invisible, ineffable, untouchable. Why aren't we paying more attention to those?
Well, you definitely are on the same page with us here.
Well, I see
the fifth dimension, my opinion.
Fifth dimension. I see it as where science meets shamanism, because I do agree. I think we all have direct connection with the universe and nature and other forces around us as a matter of course. That's actually a normal thing, and we just haven't been paying attention.
We're not paying attention. We have a supercomputer. Every human being has a supercomputer sitting on their shoulders.
Yeah.
And they take their eyes off the ball. How did the Yankees win the World Series so much in the 1950s? Because people couldn't take their eyes off the pinstripes. We can't take our eyes off the material side, and we put all the weight on that.
Yeah.
We should be putting a lot more weight on the invisible, ineffable.
Yeah, good point. I would tend to agree with you on that.
Yeah, Steve, we got to go to a break.
Well, thanks for calling.
Really appreciate
it.
Thanks for being there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, take care. And we're off, and we'll be right back after these sponsors.
Okay, back to the Dr. Future Show, and we're going to go from essentially accessing the cosmic Google to talking about our U.S. Navy developing a fleet of drone mother submarines.
Drone mother submarines?
Well, they're called mother subs.
What makes them a mother sub?
Because they can release smaller robots.
I see.
No, you see there.
So the mama sub has a horde of baby subs.
Yes.
You can let go out into the sea and explore.
And some of our Navy budget has gone towards developing this vast network of drone submarines that can explore shallow parts of the ocean, parts that normally aren't accessible to us.
Mm-hmm.
Like just off the coast of China and interesting strategic places where we want to keep track of activities.
Yes.
Our species and otherwise.
Reading, as we were researching this article, we came across another article about the artificial islands that are being created in these shallow spots in the China Sea.
Yeah, our pundits say that's a Chinese tactic for grabbing more land and more territory.
Right, because the international territorial laws are that 12 miles from the border of a country is national, and then outside of that is international.
Yeah.
And so apparently China is going into some of these
what's an island?
Shallow areas of the ocean and just dumping sand enough to like make an island there.
Yeah, I wonder what minimally constitutes an island.
Here's 12 more miles of our national territory here in the sea in the, around this island.
And what about anchored islands? Do they count?
Oh, good point. Yeah, is a barge? Does a barge have the same rights?
What if you root it into the ground in some way? Mm-hmm. So it looks like it's part of that area, and you create this long rooted tube, kind of like a dandelion, with the dandelion flower itself being the ship, the island on the surface.
Yeah.
Now, wouldn't that be considered territory? It's a brilliant game because it doesn't end, right?
And the whole thing is like, who's going to protest? It's kind of like when the New World was being explored by the Europeans and they came to the new land and started claiming it for the Old World, right? It was up to whoever was there to stop them.
Old rules apply.
Otherwise, new rules, right?
Until they don't.
Until they don't. Yeah. So anyway, apparently, this is somewhat of a cause for concern among people watching the geopolitics.
Oh, yeah. Territoriality has always been a concern of our species, and it always will drive the equation, which is why it's driving this technology.
Yeah.
The drone tech naturally will go into our defenses and our immune system, if you will, to look at what's actually going on.
Right. I imagine that's what these mother drone ships are for, is to basically scout in these areas where we
Spying is the first use. Remember, they're robots, so they'll be able to bring molecules there. They'll be able to, like, drop sensors in place. They'll be able to drop landmines, I guess it wouldn't be landmine, it would be water mines, if you will, underwater.
Right.
They could do all kinds of, whatever humans can think up, they can do.
Right.
They're robots.
Well, it would be nice if we could come up with some way of thinking about exploring the sea that gave us the equivalent of an international space treaty. Like, now that we have more technology than we did in the past.
There's a lot of maritime law out there.
There is, but maritime law was invented when ships were the state of the art, and 12 miles off the coast was a lot of territory, and there was a lot of unexplored ocean. But we could put sensors under every meter of the ocean over the next 100 years, and then the ownership of the ocean is going to be a very different question. So rather than like fighting wars about it, we should anticipate it and approach the conversation on behalf of the realm, as it were, of the entire planet. Like, how do we want the sea to be managed for the good of all?
Well, it is a realm in which it involves all of us.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, let's not go to war over these shifting definitions.
Yeah, we're not going to claim international waters as territory. We have to play by different rules.
Uh-huh.
A shared rule structure,
right,
which kind of exists but could be evolved a lot more, especially when it comes to peaceful uses of the seabed.
Yeah. I mean, we are the blue planet generation. We have seen the world from off-world. We know it's one big ball.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that in the future it is a big ball to be here.
Yeah, and any profits made from mining under there got to help clean up the plastic on the oceans, you know, those gyres.
The thing about making rules is somebody has to be bigger than the rules to enforce the rules. Otherwise, rules are just lip-flapping. So I think we should have less rules overall and more common sense and some kind of process where we look for agreement before we disagree and then try and overpower each other, you know, like just a different approach that's more freedom in.
Well, I'm thinking of a few big barges off the coast of Santa Cruz and us throwing our own version of a Burning Man party here, you know, just 11 miles off international waters, when, you know, peaceful use of the sea surface. Many things are possible. We start thinking of the sea as the technology makes it more available for us to consider as a place to play and work. It's going to become an interesting thing. And us being a community by the sea, be good to think about a little bit in the future, which is now.
Yes, coming fast.
Yes. The drone fleet is what's going on. And what's interesting there is that, yes, it does occur in the military world initially, but it was not going to be long, folks, before we'll all have access to information coming from mother drone ships off the coast of wherever we want to be.
Yeah, I think it could be a channel.
Yeah,
right?
Why would
an
you
internet
want to?
Channel.
Well, you'll have a
mother
virtual reality.
Ships.
You'll be able to visit there on command. If you want to go down, say, to the bottom of the ocean for a few minutes during a break, you can.
Yeah, some of
be
them
there.
Could be like a subscription.
Wouldn't that be nice
club?
Use of your tax dollars at work?
What if you could control one of them remotely? You know, I'm sure they've got cameras.
You have. That's one of the great things over at Maritime.
Virtual scuba diving.
Yeah.
In the China Sea.
Yeah, it's something that at your fingertips. That can be doable. As a matter of fact, I think some of the high-end stuff is doing that already. Like over here at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Mbari, they have some underwater submarines that explore the chasm here that are just like stepping into a cockpit of an airplane or spacecraft. Amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting to come. And I think it ties in with the whole idea of creating a global economy. That makes sense and how it's shifting. And I think we'll do a show just on that because there's a changing face of money right now and how it works and how it's changing and, you know, where we're going in terms of that whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That'd be good to get some people who are knowledgeable about that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we got 5 minutes left before our special guest. You know, what's interesting is that our guest is one of Santa Cruz's great storytellers.
It's true. I'll tell you.
And the stuff we're talking about with portals and all that, she's going to take it into the, she'll take it into, I was going to say outer space, but that doesn't quite do
inner
justice.
Space.
You think?
Interdimensional space.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
For real, man.
Right. So folks, just to tip the scale a little bit, we're introducing Kaya Dorius, who is a really talented Santa Cruz performer, writer, and now director of a wonderful TV show. And she's going to be here in the next hour telling us about her project, which she's been working on for the last 5 years. She started working on it at community television, when community television was still open for the general
public. Yeah, sorry. It gets
public.
Our whole community involved with playing with all these concepts in a fun and creative way.
Yeah, and learning the old myths with the new tools. We can't wait until we get a preview of what she's going to be sharing in the next little while.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a little micro summary of some of the other stories I have. We'll probably delve into in some future now time moment. There we've come up with a new type of metal that's kind of like the one used in the Terminator series, the liquid metal.
Mm-hmm.
That's programmable liquid metal that can change shape and form.
All right, shape-shifting metal.
Yeah, these are on our links page, drfutureshow.com/links. You can check out the details of some of these if they strike your attention. There's a study doing on mutants, real-day modern mutants, people who have or should have devastating diseases, but they don't. Genetically, should have.
This is fascinating. So, yeah, there was some DNA research done on hundreds of thousands of people, and among the people who were studied, they were looking specifically for some genetic deformities or deficiencies that caused chronic disease. And they found people who had the genetic code for these problems.
But didn't
they
get it. Right? They're carrying these mutations.
Very tiny number, 13 people out of 200,000. So
their puzzling genetic resilience could hold clues to curing crippling diseases.
Yeah, great story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what else? Countdown. As we rush to the top of the hour. Come
on,
time travel.
Top
speed.
Another thing is that there was a new use for drones that I really liked, where you take several drones at once, each with different sensors on, and they focus them all on one topic or one person. Like this North Korean volcano. We'll have lots of drones go over it and study it, with some using thermographic analysis, others looking at the physical frequency domains of light, other ones looking at geomagnetism information, and they all send in the information simultaneously to create a live picture of something.
Wow.
And it could be like a volcano, it could be a human being that they aim at.
Swarm
a sort of a drone
cam science team.
There's a very interesting piece on how people are doing that now.
Wow. You know, it makes me think of fly's eye, right? You know how
the opposite of fly's eye, really.
The opposite of a fly's eye, right?
Right.
Having all the eyeballs outside in the sky above looking down at the thing together.
So from the many, they see the one. Boy, that's metaphysical even, man. Also, the other thing, the dinosaurs, it's really interesting that it wasn't they were taken out by the asteroid. It's just that they were already on their way out.
Oh, yeah, for 40 million years.
Yeah, 40 million years they were going extinct, and then kaboom, they were there. They're really extinct. So I thought that was a very interesting piece on that as well. So that's it.
And for the first hour.
For the first hour, yes.
More
stay tuned. We will take our stories to another level of manifestation in the second hour. You listen.
And you're listening to KCO Santa Cruz, the Dr. Future Show. We'll be back after the news, traffic, weather, and more Dr. Future.